Hello and welcome in to the Disrupt Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Reams, and today our guest is Justin Jacobson Esquire. He's an entertainment, sports, and esports attorney based out of the Jacobson firm in New York City. He represents Moody, who is the fourth overall pick to the Kings GG in the NBA 2K draft, as well as esports athletes in a variety of different games. Justin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mitch. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a beautiful Friday as we're recording this.
Well, it's a little gloomy in New York, but, you know, I guess they say about April.
Yeah, that doesn't come as a huge shock to me.
But yeah, you know, it's Friday, so that's always a good one.
That's always good. So, on this podcast, we're going to be talking about the NBA 2K League. Justin's very involved with the NBA 2K League, representing players on four different teams, I believe it is. We're going to talk about Twitter versus Instagram, and why the esports community has gravitated so hard to Twitter, as opposed to the traditional sports, which is involved with Twitter, but just the social followings of people in esports are very Twitter-skewed versus Instagram. And then we're also going to talk about the jock tax and how the international nature of esports really makes it where taxes are being paid to becomes a very complicated question, even more complicated than traditional sports in a lot of ways, who are all based in America. It's all through the IRS, the American tax system. Well, when your majors are in Krakow and they're in Romania, how do taxes get distributed? So we'll be talking a little bit about that, and then we're going to finish up with some talk about the collective bargaining agreements and whether Riot and the Overwatch League are really going to hammer out these CBAs that have been talked about for so long. But right now, let's start with the NBA 2K League. Justin, was I right? You represent players on four different teams?
Yeah, I'm currently working with players on a few different teams and, you know, in contact with most of the teams in the league and a lot of the players. So, you know, as you mentioned, I'm very involved in the day-to-day affairs, including some legal and business stuff, and PR and marketing, and really helping ensure that these players and these professional gamers understand their responsibilities and approach their careers properly. Because, you know, as you see with a lot of these issues that pop up in the news, if you don't handle things properly, whether it's visas, whether it's how you act on stream or during a match, or the way you look at your contracts with potential enormous buyouts that are very prohibitive to your career mobility, there's a lot of issues that just pop up when you don't understand what you're doing or you don't do it properly.
Definitely. And this happened very quickly for a lot of NBA 2K players from Moody, I know you represent. He was playing in pro-ams before, but really, the NBA 2K timeline, the Pro-Am started in January, the Combine was in February, interviews are done in March, and then the draft was April 4th. And now players are on their team, so that's really quick.
Yeah, the season starts May 1st, next week.
Yeah, the season starts with the first major tournament. What's the buyout? What's the prize money? I saw it earlier, but I didn't write it down.
$100,000 total prize money.
$100,000.
Do pretty well on it, I would say. And top four teams usually, you know, have the biggest payouts.
Yeah. And so for people not familiar with the NBA 2K League, 17 NBA teams out of the 30 NBA teams have NBA 2K franchises and will be competing in the first season. I think we can expect that number to increase as the years go on. But right now, 17 teams will be competing, and they'll be competing for this banner chain. I saw this news come out today. Basically, there's three tournaments, and the winner of each gets a banner. And if the same team wins all three, then they form to create a banner chain, which...
Like a super banner.
A super banner.
Like Megatron, you get your three championship banners together, and you get a super one.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, you combine them all the forces combined. They're calling it the trifecta.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all about marketing, right? It's the quest for the trifecta, like the quest for the three-peat.
I love it. And that gets right into what we were talking about. So brands have been very excited about esports for a while, but the mainstreaming with the NBA coming in with this full support and the NFL, the NHL, massive leagues getting involved with esports, now you're seeing brands really pick up their, okay, now is the time. We were thinking about esports, now we are getting into esports. And that's happening a lot around the NBA 2K League.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening really in all esports, you know, from Overwatch, League of Legends, to CSGO, and, you know, even these newer ones like PUBG and Fortnite, you see a lot of non-endemic brands, Sour Pouch, Audi, Gillette, Mercedes, Coke, Red Bull, ones that are traditionally in all the other entertainment world, really honing in and focusing on esports and trying to get their product in this key demographic. However, you know, as we were starting to talk about, there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between some of brands' traditional, what they're called, key performance indicators, which essentially tell you how well a marketing campaign did, how well what you're doing is received. Generally, this stuff is kind of based on the engagement, the content received, and total impression. So engagement is, you know, how the viewers interacted with the content. How many clicks you get, how many retweets, how many likes, you know, what the view rate is. Do they just click on the video and close it? They watch half the video, they watch the full video. All these different metrics give brands an idea of how well the content that they're creating is viewed and how well it's doing. You know, if you have content that's viewed by thousands and thousands of people and they watch the whole thing, that's a pretty good indicator that you have pretty good content. If you have a lot of people, you know, thousands of people clicking on something and ending after 5 seconds, you can assume that maybe the content isn't as engaging as, you know, some of the others. And then when you talk about impressions, that's actually like the total number of views and clicks and retweets. And this is how brands usually able to quantify how well a marketing campaign does. You know, I got 10 million impressions because these influencers retweeted it and these publications covered it and, you know, all of these different attendees tweeted about it and used the hashtag. So these are all the different impressions that brands usually look at to determine how well the marketing campaign that they're doing is and what return they're getting on it.
Definitely. So, it's like quantifying, like, Twitter, quantifying your tweets and really bringing back the metrics like you see for ads and stuff. And it's like, hey, how is our social media doing? How can we improve it?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, most people, you know, especially the demographic that they're targeting, which is, you know, the 16 to 25, the kind of college age, young professional world, they're hooked to their phone, you know, they're hooked to their smartphone, their gadgets, their computers, their iPads. They always have some kind of screen that's connected to Wi-Fi or internet capability. So, you know, just the amount, the frequency that the demographic uses social media and, you know, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook just really shows the importance of it and why a lot of brands focus on using social media as a way to promote their product.
Definitely. And so that got into a little bit of what we wanted to talk about, which is esports and how Twitter-focused it is. If you look at traditional sports, LeBron is probably just as active as he is on Instagram as he is on Twitter, and the followers show that. You have more of a one-to-one ratio, and the engagement is much higher on Instagram. For by and obviously this isn't across the board rule, but by and large, Instagram does really well for traditional sports athletes. But in esports, that's not necessarily the case. Twitter is the preferred platform of most people. And really, Justin, I'm just kind of curious why you think that is.
I mean, you know, the biggest reason why is most traditional sports, NFL, NBA, MLB, they have just so many, there's just so much coverage. You have numerous papers in each state or city covering the teams. You have just large national and international publications. Almost every single media outlet, you know, Times, Chicago Tribune, LA, you know, LA all of these different major publications have some sports department, some sports, you know, writers that their job is to continuously create this content. And esports, especially in its earlier days, there was no ESPN, there was no Sporting News or any of these publications that were solely focused on esports. Most of the news and most of the conversation regarding it happened mostly on Twitter. And that was really because it's an international thing. You get very quick responses, and you're able to really engage with other people who are interested in it a lot easier than you could on, you know, any other platforms, especially early on. So what happened was a lot of teams and players and just fans just kind of gravitated and started to use and build up Twitter because that's where the conversation was. And just over time, that and, you know, to a lesser extent, Reddit and some of these other Discord kind of newer platforms, this was where a lot of the conversation was taking place. This was how a lot of teams and players interacted with each other. And as a result, many of these top gamers accumulated large followings. Like, kind of what you're saying, you know, one of the biggest gamers in the world, Bergensen, has 1.4 million followers on Twitter and only a little over 300,000 on Instagram. While 300,000 isn't something to, you know, turn your nose at, we're talking about, you know, over a million, nearly a million and a half, versus, you know, less than 350,000. That's a pretty big difference, especially for someone of that caliber. So, you know, it really just kind of shows that while, you know, Instagram is more of the preferred use for a lot of millennials and users in general, esports is much more Twitter focused, and as a result, most of the esports competitors have focused on building those platforms, and that's where most of their, you know, interactions with fans and other gamers happen.
Definitely. And just right now, while you were talking, I looked up LeBron as a point of reference. His Instagram, 40 million followers. His Twitter, 41 million followers. So, like we said earlier, that 1-to-1 ratio, which is more active in sports, and then if one skews higher, it's oftentimes going to be the Instagram profile of the athlete and not the Twitter profile.
Yeah, because, you know, as we started to kind of go into, based on how brands determine the success of what they're doing, it's become a lot more Instagram focused, especially brands that are very, very visually driven ones, such as fashion products, you know, most goods and services are really, you need a picture of him, you know, him holding the can, him wearing the hat, him wearing the sunglasses. You know, it's very visually driven, and that's really what Instagram is. You know, Twitter has the whole image component, but it's not the whole basis of it, where Instagram has always been an image sharing platform since it started.
Exactly. And It's just an interesting conversation, because that's how brands have identified. They're like, hey, this is Instagram's where we connect. So now brands have to shift, and they have to meet esports. And this has been a constant thing. You can't just get into esports. As a non-endemic brand, you can't just jump in to esports, because the community is going to be like, no, you're gone. And we've seen really good activations. Mercedes comes to mind, and the way they really embrace the meme about their car and its superior performance. That was a couple of years ago now. But it was a CSGO event, but I can't remember which one. But Mercedes did a really good job of like embracing as a non-endemic brand. But then we've also seen brands sort of miss the ball, and you have to be able to meet esports fans where they are, which is on Twitter.
You know, it's kind of the dilemma that I was encountering a little bit when I was, you know, working with a few different players, is that, you know, talking to these brands, and they're, oh, what's Instagram following like? Like, what's the engagement on that? And trying to explain to them that the primary focus, and if you look at the numbers for, you know, take the 2K League, for example, the numbers of their followers compared to what they have on Instagram, there's a reason that you start seeing almost all of these kids that were just drafted creating Instagram and really trying to get people to get over there and focus on that, because, you know, there may be people in their ears letting them know that, hey, you know, while it's great that you have this good Instagram following, you know, this good Twitter following, if you don't take care of Instagram and have a presence there and begin to understand why a lot of these visually driven brands want that to be their primary focus, you're going to have a lot of trouble down the line. So I'm sure that you've been seeing almost all of these 2K players creating Instagram and just trying to have some sort of presence.
Definitely.
Whereas a month ago, none of them had it, really.
Exactly. And if they did have it, now it's private because they were not in the public spotlight back then. So they might have one, change the name.
They're like askew. Like, you know, for instance, the top pick, you know, Dimes has, you know, over 11,000 followers on Twitter and maybe 200-300 on Instagram. So while he was, you know, on Conan and on ESPN this week, you're trying to explain to a brand how the number one pick is so prestigious and associated, and then you're showing them these kind of numbers when they're used to looking at much larger ones. Because, you know, you mentioned LeBron, 40 million. While he's near the top, even the lesser known guys are six figures plus, you know, $2-3 million, 2-3 million followers for some of the, you know, the B and C list kind of guys. And then when you get to the LeBrons and the D Wades and the Carmelos, you're at 20-30-50 million kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think a large part of that is just the fact that players in esports are often normal, average people. For professional athletes, they're 6'6 and gigantic, and people want to see pictures of them, I think, because it's like, wow, that's an athlete. And then esports people, I mean, by and large, they're just average, everyday Joes. So people are...
You.
Yeah, they're just like me or you, and they're less visually interesting.
As a viewer, it's a lot more relatable seeing someone who's like, you know, 5'10", well, you know, not jacked and cut like these dudes that can run a 440 that is competing at such a high level, and just watching how talented they are, I think it's a little bit more relatable because, like, oh, wow, this guy's like me. You know, maybe I'm not as amazingly good as he is at Counter-Strike, but the point is that he's not 6'5", 230, you know, kind of specimen. So I think there's a little bit more relatability to, you know, the common person, the viewer. That's like, oh, that looks kind of more like me than, you know, when you're watching an NBA game.
And I think every kid growing up who played sports had that moment where they were like, wait, I had it when I was in high school. I was a post. I was a four. I stopped growing at 6 foot. There wasn't a lot of upward momentum for me. Even the varsity team was, unless I could dribble and shoot, which I wasn't great at, I had a nice hook shot, but eventually I had to come to terms with the fact that posts are just taller than me. They ultimately, no matter how good I am, how skilled I am, if I don't grow 6 inches, there's no way I can continue playing this position. And that happens to people in every sport all over the place. Like, quarterbacks, every football players all the time just get outclassed. Basketball, it's to be an athlete, you have to be lucky and driven.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so amazing that you have this group of amazingly talented athletes that are just leagues above what, you know, most people can do.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping, like, somebody from really just grinding NBA 2K, besides the fact that those other guys have been grinding NBA 2K and are ahead of the curve, but it is possible. There's no physical limitation to stop somebody from becoming an NBA 2K pro. It's all skill and time and dedication.
And, you know, learning, you know, like they say, there's 2K IQ and there's basketball IQ. You know, there's certain things in the game that you could do that you can't get away with, and, you know, just little nuances that, you know, even playing with some of these pros, just like in, you know, pickup games kind of thing, you see the little things they pick up. Like, I was playing with one of these big men, and, like, every time you'd feed him the ball, you'd take half of an inch in front of the basket and make it every time. Whereas most normal guys, you get the ball, you're under the basket, you're just going to shoot it. And, like, the difference between making it every time and, you know, maybe not making it one or two of those times, get that little step forward. And, you know, most of us wouldn't even notice it. You know, you're just playing. But when you're, like, actually trying to focus on and learn what makes, you know, these guys that next level. It's the little things. And that's even what a lot of the NFL players that I talk to, like, we've had extensive conversations where it's like, yeah, like, everyone's amazing. It just gets to the next level where you pick up on, are their feet, you know, close, like they're going to run out? Is 1 foot back, like he's going to block? Like, you know, there's a lot of different tells that you start to pick up on when you kind of take away everything else.
Yeah, you look at Damian Lillard, he looks at when players have fallen off the front of their feet, the second, all those guards, they're waiting just to see the weight of the defender drop to the back of the foot. They go from their toes to the back of the foot, and that is when they start their drive. You ever wondering why for like 8 or 9 seconds, one of those star guards is out there just sort of dribbling, looking at him? They're waiting for that momentum to shift back, and that's the moment. That's the little tiny thing they need to be like, now I'm attacking.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, I remember a couple years ago, Revis was talking about Randy Moss and how he was, every time Randy Moss's hands were like kind of tensed up, you knew he was blocking for a run. And when he's a little bit more free with his arms kind of by his side, it kind of gave away he was going out for a pass. And that was like when Revis was just destroying him on the Patriots. So it was just like little tells that are the difference between, you know, the professionals and, you know, everyone else.
Definitely. And we've gotten a little sidetracked. Justin and I, we're both huge sports fans, so we could talk about this forever, but this is an esports podcast, so we're going to have to direct the conversation back to some of the tax stuff we mentioned up at the top of the show. So, the doc tax, which is an article you wrote, it was an article you contributed to, I should say. It wasn't just you.
Yes, me and my fellow CPA friends co-authored an article where we kind of looked at some of the tax issues that are relevant to a professional gamer. And what you first mentioned is what's so-called the jock tax. And what that is really a non-resident income tax for individuals who are earning income within a state. So, for instance, you live in Florida and you play for the Heat, but you're also playing on the Miami Heat. You also play other teams in different states. So you go to New York and play the Knicks. You go to Massachusetts and play the Celtics. You go to Tennessee and play the Grizzlies, etc. And basically what these states do is, because you're a non-resident, is they tax you for the income you earn, which is your game check, in their state. And that's kind of called the jock tax. And in New York, the tax is kind of based on what's called your duty days, which is actually the amount of days that you're doing work, whether it's media appearances, practices, a game, in the state of New York. So what's interesting is a lot of these 2K players are kind of, this is the first time they're really getting exposed to the jock tax, because all their games are getting played in New York, so they're getting taxed for that, as well as the state that their team is in. Because, as I said, you're paying taxes on the state you're earning income in, as well as these other states that you're earning these game checks in.
Definitely.
So it's just something that, you know, they have to be aware of, because if you don't pay these taxes, you can run into big problems, whether it's penalties and interest accruing, or worse, where they actually come after and try to garnish your wages. And, you know, if you have property or, you know, stocks or bonds or anything else, you know, they can try to get it from that.
Yeah. Even at the absolute worst case, there is possible jail time if you, I mean, obviously if it's an incidental mistake.
You know, like if you're hiding millions of dollars kind of thing, then, you know, there's that potential.
But that's just where tax evasion is a very, very important subject, and knowing how to do them correctly, especially now, it's a lot more complicated. People who are working in one state already mess up their taxes. Then you have to mess up with the jock tax, and professional representation becomes more and more important. Justin?
Yeah, and, you know, the idea is that you don't want to have the IRS sending you a letter. You don't want the local states who, you know, the thing is that your team, your employer, sends official documentation saying, hey, we paid X amount of money to Justin. So there's a paper trail that says this money was earned. So it's really on you, as the person who earned it, to file your taxes and to handle it properly. Because usually what the government may do is they just may guesstimate what you owe, send you a bill, tack on interest and late penalties, and, you know, and just keeps accruing until you pay it, or until you enter into some sort of payment plan or some way that you're paying it.
Definitely.
So, you know, that's one of the biggest issues and expenses that a lot of gamers have. Another one that you were kind of talking about a little bit is kind of tournament winnings and how those are taxed, and being that many of these tournaments are international, and, you know, you have foreign citizens, whether it be U.S. or other countries, competing in a different country that they're not a citizen of. So typically, these tournament winnings are taxed based on where you earn them. So if you earn it in a tournament in Sweden, it's based on whatever the Swedish tax law is. If you earn it in U.S., you know, as with the big Dota 2, the international, they get taxed on U.S., which, you know, there's an article that I cited in my article where about one-third of the huge prize money that these guys won went to taxes. So, you know, one-third of the $10 million prize was a lot of taxes because it was earned in the U.S.
So is that the only place, like, if I lay out, take, you like you said, international tournaments, is it all just to where the tournament was being held? If it's a Russian esports organization with a player from Kazakhstan, this is a situation that actually happened. I'm talking about PGL Krakow, where Gambit Esports won. That tournament was held in Poland. They were led in part by Andrey N., who's from Kazakhstan, Gambit Esports, based out of Russia. So based on what you're telling me, they'd be paying taxes based on the Polish structure?
Yeah, so that winning, yeah. So basically, you know, each tournament has their own rules that would list how things are taxed, but traditionally it's based on the host country. So I was looking at, you know, one of the dream hacks that was happening in Romania, the rule said your tournament winnings will be taxed at the 70% Romanian rate for, you know, earnings. So it specifically said that what you earn is going to be taxed at this rate, and tell us where you, how you want it paid. And it just, it's just one of these things where it's part of an expense. You know, you have to anticipate that a certain percentage of your winnings are going to go towards taxes. And that's where, you know, accounting and other professionals come in to help you get certain write-offs and figure out the best ways to mitigate and try to recover some of these taxes. Another major thing that is usually taxed are the actual salaries that the player earns. Some organizations pay the player weekly or monthly or bi-weekly, and you just kind of pay taxes on that as you would any income. If, you know, you're considered an independent contractor, then you have to take care of all of it on your own. But if they're paying you as an employee, they usually deduct all of these different withholdings. And that's definitely a much more complicated distinguishing thing than we can go into now.
Yeah, this whole area is super, super complicated. And as esports continues to grow, these considerations as prize pools keep getting larger, tournaments get larger, more people are involved, more countries get involved, esports organizations come from more places. It's going to be a very complicated ecosystem. Even more complicated than traditional sports in a lot of ways, because American leagues are based out of America. Like the NBA 2K yeah. League, you have to deal with individual state taxes, and that's complicated. But
I mean, there's Canada, so you do have to deal with, you know, that.
A bit of international.
That the people up in Toronto are learning about firsthand is, you know, being a non-Canadian citizen earning income there, the tax rate is pretty high. Because the tax rate for Canadian citizens is high to begin with because of, you know, the nationalized medicine and everything.
So, oh, that's, you know, interesting.
That's something that a lot of, you know, most, you know, there's only, what, one or two teams in Canada other than hockey in any of the other leagues?
Yeah, it's like the Blue Jays, the Raptors, but it's Toronto, basically. Like,
yeah, like, is Vancouver, do they even have?
No, the Grizzlies are gone. They left in the 90s, whenever that was, and
yeah, so it's really
Vancouver,
you know,
can
much hockey. At Montreal doesn't have Expos anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It really is only Toronto, it feels like, which is just I think the only reason it survived because it's just right over the border. Although I guess Montreal is sort of as well, and so is Vancouver. But
yeah, so, and you know, then some of the other things that gamers have to be aware about is taxes on the money they earn from streaming, which includes the money from advertisements as well as donations or tips that viewers give you. While it may be, you know, we may characterize as a donation to them, the government doesn't see it that way.
No.
You know, you're not a charity that they're donating to. You're not. So it's considered income, and you have to be aware that this money is taxed and that there's a paper trail that, you know, Amazon who owns Twitch and Google who owns YouTube would submit. So if you don't file taxes and declare this money, again, you could start running into issues with penalties and interest accruing. And then the final, you know, biggest thing that players have to worry about is, you know, their sponsorship and endorsement money, whether it's money that's paid to them or what's called trade in kind, which is free product. You know, whether you're working with an airline company that gives you free mileage, or you're working with a clothing brand who, you know, outfits you with a whole wardrobe of stuff.
Sure. Esports is headphones, gaming chairs, PCs.
Yeah, exactly. If you get a really nice computer and a whole, you know, rig setup, while it didn't cost you anything, the government considers it, you know, a fringe benefit and requires you to basically pay taxes on what the fair market value of it is. So even though it seems like it's free to you, it still actually is something taxed. Like if, for instance, you get a car in a deal, you don't just get a car free and clear. You'd have to pay taxes on what the actual car costs. You don't have to pay for the full car, but you have to pay the taxes on buying that kind of car.
Funny enough, this has actually been an issue for Price is Right. A lot of times they gift different items that are random items, and the taxes that contestants who won that item, I'm doing air quotes that you can't see, who won that item are too high. And they end up, yeah, it's not worth getting the dresser or whatever it is, the mahogany dresser, because you have to pay $2,000 on an $8,000 dresser.
Yeah, so exactly, and it's one of those things where it's not the first thing that comes to your mind when you're thinking about getting something for free.
Yeah, free is not paying for it, but you do have to pay for it at some point. Nothing's free in this world.
Exactly, and if you don't have, you know, someone like me or an accountant or, you know, CPA or one of these people in your corner reminding you about these things, or better yet, telling you, okay, well, you just got this wad of money. Pretty much if you have to put about a third of it to the side, you know, or something of that nature, so that you can prepare for the taxes that you might have to pay at the end of the year. And, you know, then another thing that, you know, gamers and everyone should be aware of is, you know, there are potential a bunch of deductions and write-offs that could help take your taxable income down, which thereby gives you, you know, potential to recoup some of the taxes you pay. You know, some of the stuff that, you know, a streamer could write off is, you know, the actual equipment they use to record the stream. Say they had to get a new microphone, or they had to buy a certain product, or get a new headset.
Yeah.
Or some of the marketing or promotional advertisements that they spend, if they're going to do paid boosts or, you know, different things to kind of get their content out. You know, any video recording or editing software. You know, if you need, you have your raw footage and you need certain editing software to make it viewable, you know, these are all things that could potentially be written off and help take down your total taxable income.
Yeah, even I'm doing that right now. That was something I had to remember. When I started doing this business, I like bought a microphone. It's like, oh no, I don't need a receipt. And then realized, no, that was a business expense. I do need that receipt to put it with my taxes so that I can write off that microphone when April comes around.
Exactly. And, you know, that is something that it's not just common sense. You know, it's one of these things that you need someone who familiar with it to even bring this to your attention. You know, that this is something that you could potentially write off. So, you know, to me, it is obviously a really huge thing in, you know, the music world, where you see a lot of you know, Rick Ross's and Lauryn Hill's and DMX and some of these really big-name talents getting into IRS issues, not paying things on time, not realizing that owning all these houses in different places and all of these, you know, all this, all these different expenses that you have to pay taxes on really adds up. And, you know, the expenditure sometimes is a lot more than you realize.
Yeah, I thought J. Cole had a really interesting, on his new album, K.O.D., the last song, 1985, he basically talks about how rappers, and he's specifically talking sort of about the new generation, tatted head to your toe rappers, but basically protect your assets. You buy a Benz, you buy a chain, you think the money's going to keep coming, but it's not. Obviously, J. Cole says it in better words than I am, but it's a really good point, like you were getting to with the Rick Rosses, the Lauryn Hills, these people who've gotten into IRS troubles because they don't take proper care of the money they get, and then just like that, it dries up, they fade out of favor for a little while, and they didn't protect their money, and just like that, all the money they earned, it's gone.
Yeah, and you know, what happened with Nicolas Cage, he owned tons of houses, and you don't realize that you have to pay real estate taxes on every single house. And the more expensive the house is, the higher the real estate taxes. So you're paying thousands upon thousands of dollars in real estate tax because you own all these houses. Plus the income that you make from all these movies. So you're just racking up your bill. And it's just one of these things that, do you really need 6 houses? I don't know. But, you know, it's one of these things that you have to be aware of what your tax exposure is. You know, there are certain states, you know, Texas and Florida, for instance, that have much better tax treatment than a New York or a California. So, you know, that's where a lot of these things come into play. I know recently there was something with Derek Jeter and that he was trying to claim his residency was in Florida, and, you know, there was a lot of, it became like a decision where they had to look at what I was mentioning earlier, these duty days, and try to calculate what percentage of days you're in New York working versus in Florida, and you know, there's a kind of a formula that just that helps you determine where your quote-unquote residency is.
Yeah.
And, you know, where your residency is determines kind of your tax rate and what taxes you're paying.
Definitely. So, the final thing I wanted to talk with you about is CBAs, collective bargaining agreements. Those are the source for basically any strike, any NBA holdout, MLB holdout, is because the Players Association and the owners didn't agree on the terms of the CBA. So the players were like, hey, we're not going to play until you meet our terms. And so that's where those holdouts that happened in the NBA in 99 or 98, MLB around that time, and there was a recent NBA one, what was that, 4 or 5 years ago now?
Yeah, and there was that recent one with the NFL where, like, they brought that lawsuit against them.
Yeah.
Where, like, Drew Brees and Tom Brady brought the lawsuit against them.
Yeah, I remember that. So, basically, esports doesn't have CBAs. And one of the reasons for that is that they're owned by Riot for League of Legends, Blizzard for Overwatch, or Valve for CSGO or Dota. Valve just couldn't care less. They don't even have the team in place to put a CBA in. But Riot and Blizzard, they have these franchise leagues with these different sports owners, but the players don't necessarily have a they don't have a players association. They don't have a players union to fall back on. And there's been a lot of talk from owners, people like Andy Miller, the owner of NRG Esports, or the founder of NRG Esports, and also an owner of the Sacramento Kings, calling for CBAs and for player representation. And it's something that Riot, I know Riot is at least thinking about it, or is working on some stuff. I'm not sure about Blizzard, I can't speak for Blizzard. But I know that there are talks, there's communication around really how you implement this. From you, from your legal background, Justin, what are the pros and cons of having a CBA, of having a players union?
I mean, at the end of the day, you have to kind of look at why is there a need for such a thing. You know, the biggest thing that I'm seeing from looking at the industry is, and what we kind of were touching on when we were talking about the tax stuff, is just a general lack of knowledge. that these individuals that are getting signed, particularly the players, to these teams, just are not in a knowledgeable position. They don't really understand the contract they're signing. They may not understand the long-term implications of it. They might not realize the amount of power that the team may have. And where a collective bargaining agreement or these player unions come in is they come in as a way to kind of balance the power, to kind of come up with a standard, you know, collective bargaining agreement where we all collectively agreed and bargained for this agreement. And the idea is that it becomes a bit more fair. You know, it's a bit more in the middle. Whereas traditionally, if you look at some of these, most of these esports contracts, especially with the major organizations, they're very much one-sided. They're very much pro-team, and that's with anything. You know, it comes to the concept of leverage. If you're a new artist and you're signing a deal with Sony Music, Sony Music's going to have the control. They're going to have most of the power. If you're Kanye signing a deal with Sony Music, you may be able to get a lot more control and power than, you know, the new artist may. So it kind of, the idea would be that this collective bargaining and the union would be a way to put everyone, every player on kind of the same footing. That we all can agree to these terms. We can all agree to this salary. We can all agree to these buyouts. We can all agree to the way our rights are licensed, what our benefits are going to be, as opposed to letting each team by team decide, having a player by player situation where, you know, one player is making substantially more than the other because maybe they have representation or they have more aggressive representation and one doesn't. So it really kind of acts as a way to even the playing field and provide the gamers with, you know, a better shot at having a deal that's a little bit more fair to their side.
And for the owners, and it prevents a lot of headaches.
From the owner's side, it really takes away one of these, oh, well, we didn't understand it, or it's, you know, contract of adhesion, take it or leave it kind of situation. We're like, we didn't have a choice. Like, obviously, we wouldn't want to sign such a one-sided agreement that has this crazy six-figure buyout in it, but we really didn't have a choice in the matter. Whereas if, you know, you have a players' association or some kind of collective bargaining agreement, this is what you kind of agree to by being part of the association, that the people that you elect to represent your interests, by them deciding on this, you're kind of approving it too.
Yeah, it provides stability, it prevents arguments, it prevents discussions, it's...
Yeah, because that's the big headache. If a player was to try to go, you know, to court and try to go a distance and invalidate a contract because it was too one-sided or it was too ambiguous or just was like, oh, you have to sign it right now, we don't want you to have a lawyer kind of thing. That really, which is, you know, sad to say, some of the situations that is occurring in esports. And later, these people are regretting entering into these situations, and they really don't have any recourse. You know, another good thing about a lot of these player associations is they have these arbitration proceedings and mechanisms in place. So where you can deal with salary disputes, you can deal with these different kind of collective bargaining issues. You know, the amount of hours, like, you know, there's a big stuff with training camp and, you know, how many hours you have to be in pads and all this stuff with the NFL. Because obviously, the more contact, the more chance for injury. The more chance for injury, you know, it just kind of puts your career in jeopardy. So these collective bargaining mechanisms kind of level the playing field and let everyone kind of be on the same page with everything.
Definitely. Definitely. Justin, that's everything I really had to talk to you. I appreciate you giving me that rundown on players' associations. I think that's something maybe we reconvene when the first one of these actually goes live, and we can talk about the deals and the terms that are laid out by the CBA. And I'm really curious if we will see a holdout by esports athletes, or if right now they don't have the leverage. Like you said, the personas. Like, if LeBron James isn't playing basketball, less people are watching. If somebody isn't playing Overwatch, it's going to have a less of an effect on... They're going to be easier... There's no LeBron James in esports, maybe Faker in Korea, but basically, people are going to be able to just replace them a little bit easier until esports athletes continue growing, continue developing their fan base in the way that traditional sports athletes have for so long, then they have the leverage, then they can start demanding the higher contracts. But as of right now, they don't even really have the leverage to enact a CBA. But it's sort of in everybody's best interest.
And, you know, and the turnaround on a lot of these players, you know, the career span is, you know, another factor of consideration that not many people have, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20-year kind of careers like you might in other sports. Yeah.
That's a good point as well. It's a good point. The shortness of contracts. Also, the young age of so many esports pros, I think, allows them to be taken advantage a little bit easier. So many pros, they go, you know, if you're following a traditional sports path, you've gone through high school, you've gone through college, you're being drafted, and ultimately you've talked to people along the way. You've been given some time to learn tax structure and what a good deal looks like and find good representation. But in esports,
there's a whole industry that's already been existing for the last 10, 15, 20, 50 years, like the music business, of lawyers and agents and managers and, you know, account, like this whole infrastructure has been existing in all the other entertainment world since their inception.
Yeah, and now we are just starting to flesh it out in the esports world.
Well, it was wonderful. I appreciate this. This was a great time, and, you know, I hope that I spotlighted some issues that are important to the viewers.
Always pleasure talking to you. There are so many legal issues in esports, and as an esports attorney, an entertainment and sports attorney as well, but also as an esports attorney, it's great tapping into your legal knowledge and to really learn about the legal side of esports, something I'm not so familiar with. Justin, is there anything you want to plug, anything you want people to be on the lookout for?
You know, just follow me on Twitter, JustinJESQ. You know, I'm always posting news and articles and everything, so feel free to give me a follow and be on the lookout. We got some good things cooking.
Yeah, his articles pop up everywhere around the net. You can find him on Sport Techie, where I also write. You can find him on the Esports Observer. You can find him just about anywhere. A variety of topics. Justin, it was a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Have a good
one. You too.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.